Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Forest Park is home to many creatures we rarely or never see, including the great horned owl. One Rand's relationship with them a little bit later in the program. But first, St. Louis has a long and rich literary tradition. Think Tennessee Williams, Eugene Field, and the late Maya Angelou. Little wonder, then, that during this National Poetry Month, Maya Angelou's work is taking center stage here. The St. Louis Poetry Center will celebrate her and her work a little later this month. And with me in studio to talk about it, Eugene Redmond, East St. Louis Poet Laureate and Professor Emeritus of English at SIU in Edwardsville. Michael Castro is St. Louis's first Poet Laureate, author of several books of poetry, and winner of numerous awards. John Vassar is a poet and currently serves as the coordinator for writers at the University of Missouri-St. Louis English Department. He is also a grad student at UMSL. Is that correct, Jason?
Recently, it's Jason.
What did I say?
John.
Oh, John, sorry. Okay. Of course, I know it's Jason.
But I currently teach at Harrisville State University. I earned my MFA in December.
All right. Well, good for you.
Thank you, sir.
You have plenty going on. That's the whole point. I'd like to start, Eugene, let me start with you. Why is Maya Angelou so important to us?
Because she breathed and she walked and she created. She made things from the old beginning of the word poetry, a maker. She made things. So into poetry, she placed her great dancing ability, her incredible storytelling ability. She could sing. She acted. And these things came along, you know, she accumulated them as she moved through life from a young child. But the stories that she told, and the people who were drawn to her because of those stories, and specific things she said, the way she said things. You know, when I first met her, she said, "Eugene, be my brother forever." Mm-hmm. So, you know, that the ability to put so much and to see so much in people and put that in the language.
Yeah. You know, I heard her say something once that I've never forgotten, and that she was on the Diane Rehm show, and she was talking about getting along with people. And she said, you know, if you want to get along with people, when you see them the first time in the day, just say, good morning, a really, really enthusiastic good morning, and give them a big smile. It will set up your day, and it will set up their day. And I've never forgotten that, because that does work. Michael Castro, your take on Maya Angelou.
Well, I think she incorporated all those things Eugene talked about. All of that was embodied in her poetry. And she was a presence. To hear and see her read, it was a performance. But it was a performance of a fully realized individual. A phenomenal woman. Her signature poem, really, that was Maya. She had lived many lives by the time she became a well-known poet.
You would expect her to do it as a performer because she was a performer during her early days.
Exactly.
And that makes a difference.
Mm-hmm.
That makes a difference.
And she was inspirational as a presence. I saw her for the first time probably 25, 30 years ago. And I've never forgotten it. I consider myself and Eugene performance poets, but she was a performer in terms of her presence, the mm-hmm. aura she gave out. Remarkable person and a very wise woman. Her wisdom came through every time she opened her mouth.
You two are closer to being contemporaries to Maya Angelou than Jason is here. So, Jason, I'm interested in your take on her as a much younger person evaluating her work and who she was.
Well, from my perspective, Maya Angelou is a legend, you know, but the more I read her work and the more I got to the honor of seeing her perform and meeting Dr. Redmond, I realized she is a person first. You know, we think about these great writers of our time and past times, and we say, wow, this is such a great person. know, figure in American history. This is a great legend. But at the fundamental level, she was a great person. And I think the celebration of her life as a person is what I take away from her work. You know, when I read her works like The Caged Bird or any of her other works, I see a person first and not someone that's larger than life. And I think that separates her from a lot of other people that we look to for guidance, like Langston Hughes, which is also a person. But Maya Angelou was so personable. Like, I had the chance to see her at a conference in Atlanta right before she passed away. And she was such a radiant presence. You know, she was such a person you can just walk up to and say hello to. She wasn't, you know, she was just very approachable. And I think that's something to be said for anyone who works in letters and who has esteem, who has amassed the amount of celebrity that she has. She never forgot who she was. Mm-hmm. And so myself, as a younger poet, I look to her as an example, as I also look to Dr. Redman and Dr. Castro.
I would also say that her work was approachable too. She was accessible as a poet. Her poems could relate to anyone. You didn't have to be an English professor to relate to her work. In fact, a lot of English professors don't, for various reasons. But I think part of her power was the directness of how she related her messages.
I just wanted to add
two things. One is that we would read to each other over the decades, you know, new work by other people. And she would read to me poems as she made them perhaps a bit more economic and, you know, in the number of words. And as she made them more accessible. A lot of poets go the other way. They may have poems that are accessible, and then they go, you know, as one poet says, you know, I want to be sufficiently obscure to please the critics. Mm-hmm. Well, she came back from that, because she'd read a poem to me and it would be very recondite and obtuse, and then she would read it 2 or 3 days later, and it would be so accessible. And one other thing, to just sort of co-sign what both Jason and Michael just said, she would also say, after she came off of a stage at an event where I wasn't, you know, present, she called me to give me a report, she would say, my brother, she said, I brought all of my female equipment to that stage. When you say everything, she said that often.
Yeah. Yeah. So my Angelou reported to you. Is that the way it was?
You know, Michael, one of the things that occurs to me, given her start in life, it was not an easy. She didn't have an easy go for it for her first good many years. That there isn't more bitterness reflected in what she wrote. There's more love. There's more compassion. There's more feeling.
Yeah, I agree.
That surprise you?
Yes and no. There are people who, so many examples of people who transcend their difficult upbringing experiences. She had the strength, the inner power and will to come out of all those things she had done, feeling guilty about a murder that had been done to reap revenge for someone who had raped her. Mm-hmm. A period of silence is all as a little girl.
She was a mute for a period of years.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, gosh, you wonder what was going through the child's head at that time. But to come through that, I mean, she was a remarkable person. I think there's no easy answer to your question.
Jason, she must have been remarkable in many ways, and obviously was. But one of the things I'm interested in getting from you during our discussion today is her ability to relate to today's young people, because there is no generational divide, it would seem. Do you see it that way? Do young people, your friends and acquaintances, look at her the same way you do?
I would say yes and no. To me, a lot of my contemporaries look to Maya Angelou as like a mother figure. You know, she was very nurturing in what she would say to people. And whenever she would do talks at different conferences or do poetry readings, she was very positive. She would always affirm positive energy. She would always have a bright smile on her face. And that, you know, that translates any generational gap. A lot of us look to her as an example of what to do when you go do a reading, you know. And I like to keep that attitude in my own self, in my own writing, to stay positive and to stay, you know, I wonder, like, what would Maya do? You know, what would she write if I was, if there was something going on in the city, like, you know, Ferguson, for example? What would Maya write about that, you know? How would she handle a reading, you know, where we had to tackle that type of issue? And the answer is that she would be very positive and nurturing. Even though, you know, it would be a difficult situation, she would make it something to, she would make everything a lesson. She would make everything something to learn from. And for me, that's such fodder for my work, because I look to her and other writers like her and say, you know, it's easy to find something to pick up from this. Like, it's, there's easy to, there's notes here that I can use from what she's doing that I write to my own writing. And so in that, I think I grow, as I grow as a writer, I become more like Maya or more like her contemporaries, in that I stay positive in the message of the work.
Michael, you've just listened to that. What do you think? I mean, you're of a different age than Jason, obviously. I don't want to keep pointing out that you're older than Jason, but it's a fact. But as you watch young people respond, not only to Maya Angelou, but to others, what are your thoughts about that? I mean, poetry continues to live.
You know, John, I'm really been meditating about that most recently, because as poet laureate, I've had an opportunity and made the opportunity, really, to have more contact with some of the things that are going on with the younger generation of poets. It's amazing. I was just at a slam competition among local high school youth that was held at Herb Arts, a room packed with people, enthusiasm off the charts, young people exploring the most difficult subject matter imaginable, young heartbreak, alcoholism and drug abuse in the family, abandonment. I mean, these were some very heavy issues. Reciting their poems by memory, if they forgot their poems in the middle, instead of it being an embarrassing situation, the audience would, come on, poet, you can do it. Come on, poet, get it down. And the poet would draw it out of themselves. Or even if they had to go back to their seat to get a piece of paper or their little iPhone to read the poem, total encouragement. So this was a competition, but it was not a competition. And then there's a group called the Seventh Grade Poetry Foundation, where seventh graders are doing the same thing. So I came out of Herb Arts, the last few contacts I've had with young poets, saying, wow, poetry has a great future. The enthusiasm is off the charts, and the empowerment that these young people feel from it is palpable.
Eugene Redmond, you picking up, getting the same vibes?
Yes, I am. And I think what Maya's contribution to all of this was that she she participated, observed, and shared, you know, with what we call a participant observer, and contributed. When she got a major contract with Hallmark to market 47 different items under her name, you know, from hat socks to Lazy Susans to cards, she was attacked. I remember reading some attacks, you know, a serious poet wouldn't write for Hallmark, you know, going to, you know, get into bed with Hallmark. And she said, I want to reach the people. You know, I want to be read. I want to be heard. And that's the way she, and I bought some of her cards. I mean, she gave me some. But later I would go to the Hallmark store when I, you know, it was a death or a wedding or, you know, shower or something, and but she wanted to be in the mix, to be heard, to be seen, to be read, and so she did all of the things. I mean, she was a consummate writer and a consummate artist, you know, whether she was playing the piano. I mean, up until she died, she took courses. This is another thing.
Really?
Yeah, so, took courses in various areas.
Well, it obviously worked, because I think if you ask most Americans today to name 10 contemporary poets, they'd be hard-pressed to do it, but she would certainly be remembered by folks because she did make herself accessible. I have to take a break, and we'll do that, and I'll come back and have some readings from you gentlemen of Maya Angelou's work. Eugene Redmond is with us in studio. He's the East St. Louis Poet Laureate. The brand new St. Louis Poet Laureate is Michael Castro. He is with us in studio, as is Jason Vassar, a poet with the University of Missouri, St. Louis, and Harris Stowe State University as well. He's all over the place. Also a poet, if I didn't mention that. Back to continue our conversation and those readings in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back. Let's start with those readings that we promised. I hope we have enough time to get them all in. I'm sure we will. Eugene Redmond, East St. Louis Poet Laureate, Michael Castro, who is the Poet Laureate of St. Louis, and Jason Vassar, who is himself a poet. Michael Castro, let's start with you. Just set it up for us, if you
okay. would. Okay. I have a piece that I wrote for Maya Angelou, and it tries to give a kind of quick overview of her life. Your presence, your grace, your inspiring presence, phenomenal, phenomenal woman. From near defeat to clear elite is quite a feat. The lives of a woman, abandoned child, rape victim, vow of silence, prostitute, waitress, calypso singer, first female streetcar conductor, wife, mother, civil rights activist, advisor to Malcolm X, dancer, actress, memoirist, professor, commencement speaker, pre-feminist feminist, inaugurator of a president, poet, phenomenal, phenomenal woman, expired yet still inspiring. Your words still breathe. You live in the minds, the spirits, the lives of those you touched, those you moved and shook with your presence, your words, your grace, your still inspiring presence. Phenomenal, phenomenal woman.
Excellent. Excellent. What a life. Mm. What a life. Mm-hmm. I mean, you ticked off, 15 different things right. there that are an entire lifetime.
Lives. Yeah.
Lives, exactly. That's exactly mm-hmm. my point. Mm-hmm. Nice job. That is wonderful. That is
Thank
wonderful.
You.
All right, Jason, let's go with you now.
Sure. So this poem, called Caged, is inspired by Maya Angelou, but also inspired by her contemporaries and their impact on my culture as a poet. Caged. When I write in form, it's easier to thematically capture the beauty in a leaf or the simplicity in a breeze. I imagine that it would be nice to watch the yellow wagtails while writing villanelles in Italy, remark on the beauty of sonnets in England, an occasional red grouse at my feet, wanting breadcrumbs, or to sketch out a haiku in Japan, at a pond under a cherry blossom, brown thrush abound. Wouldn't it be linguistically rich in the words that would come from the scenery? Allowing myself to write in free verse, however, I cannot help the rage that's inside, reflecting on how hard it is. While speaking in Kwansabas, where they remind me of my place, that always lets me know that I am not a bird, but something other. Bound to the ground, wings clipped, where I cannot jump from this trap. Looking to the sky with green eyes, flutter, flight. How so moves the clouds.
Excellent as well. Excellent as well. Mm. Caged being the operative word is so closely associated with Maya Angelou.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, right. What do you think, gentlemen? I'll talk to the older gentleman, if you will. You've got a young rival here. He's on his way.
Up and coming.
Yeah. All right, Eugene Redmond, let's
Way
turn
up.
To you. Let's see if you can top that.
Maya loved to give parties and to attend parties. They have three Kwansabas. They mentioned 49-word poems. Mm-hmm. Just mm-hmm. Maya's birthday is Daze Kwanzaa. Who can snap a finger like Maya and have our chests swell open like sesame? In the Caribbean Sea, beached among palms in Florida, or California with Oprah's legends, on Reynolds, Winston-Salem Island, vista and vintage spread like wine and music and bows of raining roses. Snap, cameras. Maya's son rides waves, S-U-N. Horror's twin is joy. So knows Maya, approximating heartquakes, jiving, still rising word zeal, whirling down whirls of sunways like a blues-aged angel moon, styling, real, reeling in bardic sotos as proud Oprah accepts baton of she palms and Maya laughs in the key of thunder. And this is a 49-word biography of Maya, Mood Maya Kwanzaa. She feeds eyes, ears, and skies with dancing loaves of poetry, baked in awareness of stamps, St. Louis, San Francisco, and Porgy and Bess. Then foretasting purple Alice's and blue Tony's, she uncages Dunbar's lyrical feast in Nasser's Egypt, in Nkrumah's Ghana, MLK's USA, and every woman's kitchen.
I noticed the word caged popped up again there. I guess
can't get away.
It's pretty much got to be there. Okay, now, do you gentlemen have a sense of rivalry at all? I mean, here you are in the St. Louis area, and you're practitioners of your craft. I noticed, Michael, you were really enjoying what Eugene and what Jason were doing. But do you sense any rivalry?
Not with these gentlemen, for sure. I mean, Eugene and I have been collaborating for over 30 years on different projects, and Jason is just a joy to be around. And really, I don't – I mean, as a young poet, I was very conscious of competitiveness and rivalries and this camp and that camp. But as I've gotten older, I'm more benign, and especially becoming a poet laureate, you kind of are required to be benign, I think. But one of my poetic heroes and mentors on the page is William Blake, who wrote, "There should be no competition among poets in the kingdom of heaven." And I really believe in that, and I've tried to live by it ever since I encountered it.
Mm-hmm. I hate to tell you, I had so much trouble with Blake when I was in college. but that's another story. That is another story. Eugene, what can you say in poetry that you can't say in prose?
Well, poetry can give a lesson without having to set up so much, without having to set up the stage with language. And you can go right to what we call in medias res, in the middle of things.
You have to draw the pictures yourself. You don't have to have it laid out for you.
I've actually created poems on the spot to illustrate this to students, just off the top of my head, to show what you can do in such a short period of time. It's like, bang, 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 the fuselage, let loose the missiles, a blood puddle formed in the shape of Africa. Now, I didn't say something like, okay, what? And I asked the kids, where are we in the poem? What has happened? Just in that.
Not just in that.
And they can tell you. They can tell you in a city, you know. They can tell you. I mean, they just start, they can talk about that for 20 minutes.
Yeah, it's like the Hemingway thing. For sale, baby shoes, never worn. There's a whole story,
right?
Yeah.
Right.
You wanted to say something.
Jumping right on that, poetry can say what actually can't be said in words. It can suggest. There's a great haiku I love by a Japanese poet named Isa that his translation goes, "This dewdrop world is only a dewdrop, and yet. This dewdrop world is only a dewdrop, and yet. It can be interpreted a lot of different ways. Three lines. The world we live in the big universe, is a dewdrop. Mm-hmm. Inside a dewdrop, there are worlds.
Sure.
Poetry is about the and yet, the reverberations of the poem. The greatest lesson I ever learned about poetry was that when I made the realization, it's not just the intellect reaction that is the power of the poem. Poem hits you emotionally, mm-hmm. spiritually. Not, there's a whole nonverbal dimension to poetry that the reader or hearer brings to it, and their associations are part of the poem.
Mm-hmm. Jason, we're just about out of time, but are you there yet? Are you there where these gentlemen are just...
Absolutely, saying? Absolutely. Poetry doesn't allow you to hide anywhere. You know, you read a poem, it's right there in front of you. You know, prose, you have to get into. You have to, as Dr. Redmond said, you have to set the scene. You have to get into the, you know, what's happening, the plot.
A lot of the work is done for you.
The poetry is there. You can't hide from it. And it forces you to ingest something quickly. You know, and so when Dr. Redmond mentioned earlier about Maya Angelou's poetry being accessible, what we learn is that as soon as you see a poem or you hear a poem, you have to see the image. You have to get the feeling that the writer wants you to feel or to see.
That's the theater of the mind, I think, is part of it. Mm-hmm. Gentlemen, I wish we had more time. We don't. But I want to thank you so much for being with us. And those in our audience who have enjoyed what they've heard today, and I'm sure they have, you'll have an opportunity to hear more with all three of my guests on Sunday, April 26th from 4 to 7 p.m. We'll be celebrating Maya Angelou at the Probstein Clubhouse in Forest Park in St. Louis. We'll have more information on our website with regard to that event, and I'm sure it's going to be great, just as this last half hour or so has been. Thank you so much, Eugene Redmond, for being with us. Michael Castro, thank you for being with us. Congratulations on your more recent appointment as Poet Laureate.
Thank you.
And Jason Vassar, thank you so much for being with us. Good luck to you as you proceed.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, coming up next, this is something of a departure. We're going to be talking about the great horned owls of Forest Park. You may have never seen one, but they are there. We'll be talking about that next on St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.